Every day, Bill Frank...
We're going to be doing one thing and one thing only.
...talks with the best guests in America about business.
You mean business?
Monkey business?
Are you ready to get down to business?
All right! Everybody's here and that means we can get down to business.
Entertainment.
Entertainment.
The entertainment capital of the world.
What kind of entertainment?
It's a storm of entertainment that brings down the house.
Sports.
Game on.
A grueling test of strength, speed, and stamina.
Wow, just like in the pros.
And the local community.
The rage in local radio.
Find out what's going on locally.
Radio keeps its eye on local events.
It's time now for the Bill Frank Radio Show on News Talk 1520 KVTA. Now, here's your host.
Bill Frank.
Hi, this is Bill Frank, and you're listening to the Bill Frank Radio Show on KVTA News Talk 1520. You can also hear me streaming over the internet at brainstormingonline.com. I'm bringing fresh perspectives to Ventura and Santa Barbara counties. My goal is to bring you interviews with thought leaders in business, entertainment, sports, and the local community. Together, we'll listen to what these people say and relate it to how we live and work in Ventura and Santa Barbara counties. The Bill Frank Show is smart radio with sharp questions aimed at intelligent guests. It's talk radio done right for the 21st century. Every show has a theme, and today's theme is business and politics. Each of my guests will share his perspective on one of these subjects. My next guest is an editor for National Review. He uncovers the hidden politics of the welfare state and documents the historical evidence that it was created to keep Democrats in power. We'll discuss his latest book, The Dependency Agenda. Kevin D. Williamson is an editor at National Review, an author, and a columnist for the New Criterion. He began his journalism career at the Bombay-based Indian Express newspaper group and has worked as a reporter, columnist, and editor at a variety of newspapers. Kevin directed the journalism program at the Institute for Humane Studies at George Mason University. Joining us from New York City. Hi, Kevin. How are you today?
I am superb. How are you?
Well, I'm fine. Thank you so much for joining me on the show today. And I love your book because you start out with just an amazing fact to sort of kick the book off. You write that each year the United States spends $65,000 per poor family to, quote-unquote, fight poverty in a country where the average family income is just under $50,000. And astoundingly, the current U.S. poverty rate is higher than before the government began spending trillions of dollars on anti-poverty programs. How can this be?
Well, the reason it works out that way is because almost none of the money spent in all of the programs we launched under the rubric of the war on poverty actually goes to poor people. For the longest time, our two biggest, most expensive entitlement programs, which are Social Security and Medicare, have largely benefited middle-class to upper-middle-class people. Who collect about two-thirds of the money overall from the entitlement state. And of course, a lot of the money goes to paying people who staff the agencies, run the bureaucracies, and particularly people who work in the private sector, both for-profit and non-profit organizations that contract with the government to provide federally subsidized services, almost none of which go to the poor, as it turns out.
Well, Kevin, I mean, in some ways, politically, doesn't that make sense? Because, after all, the middle-class people on whom the money is being spent are the voters, generally speaking. The poor people, as a percentage or group, don't vote as strongly as middle class.
Yeah, I've always told people that's the reason why it'll be much easier to reform Medicaid than it will to reform Medicare, because it's easy to short-sell the interests of poor people, but it's not very easy to short-sell the interests of the middle class and the elderly. And, of course, people over 65 are the wealthiest single demographic of Americans and the most active voters and all the rest of it. So it's no surprise that the vast concentration of benefits go to middle-class families. Yeah, because you're right, because they've got the political clout. And for all the rhetoric that accompanies the welfare state, war on poverty and what would they do without it, nobody really, objectively speaking, seems to care very much about the poor. I mean, if you just take a pure measure of where the dollars go, that's not the case.
Well, now that's, I think, a little unfair, Kevin, because there are lots and lots of charities out there that are helping the poor, and people invest in the charities outside of government investing. And I would say that that is probably more humane and more directly targeted towards the poor than perhaps some of the government programs. Your thoughts?
Oh, yeah. I meant no one in government, no one in politics cares about the poor. Sure, lots of people care about the poor. I mean, you walk down the streets, you see churches, you see soup kitchens, you see charities, you see people just out of their own pocket trying to help people. Now, Americans are an extraordinarily generous people. We give a higher proportion of our income to charity than any other advanced society in the world. So, yeah, we care a lot about the poor. The political class doesn't, but they are able to pull the wool over people's eyes with this kind of rhetoric. And and painting these catastrophic scenarios if we no longer support the welfare state, if we no longer give them a couple of trillion dollars a year to blow away, then, oh, you know, poor little 9-year-old orphans will be starving out in the street and all the rest of it, which is just nonsense. That's not actually the way the programs are structured.
Well, thank you for clarifying that. My guest is Kevin Williamson. He's the author of the book, The Dependency Agenda. Another startling fact in reading your book, roughly half of all Americans right now depend on government assistance of one sort or another, be it food stamps or unemployment insurance, whatever. How did we get to this point, Kevin?
Well, the welfare state always wants more clients. You know, if you're in government, your prestige, your budget, your standing doesn't come from solving the problem. It comes from the size of the problem that you're asked to solve. And so as these problems get bigger, you get more prestige, bigger budgets, more power, and all that. So government is always looking for new people to include in the program. You know, when they were first debating the creation of Medicare, then as now, people over 65 were the wealthiest people in society, and it came up in Congress in the debate. You know, only 15% of the people who are over 65 have below average levels of net worth. Why are we creating a program that covers 100% of those people when only 15% of them are actually, you know, in some way in need? And that, of course, is because, you know, you get a lot more power from having a program that covers everybody than having a program that only covers marginal, politically unimportant people.
All right. Well, my guest is Kevin Williamson. So, Kevin, let's trace it back. You say the cycle of dependency began with the Great Society under President Lyndon Johnson. That's your thought. Why start there? Why not track it all the way back to Franklin Delano Roosevelt and the New Deal?
Well, obviously, Social Security came out of the New Deal, and that's an important one. But the New Deal was fundamentally different from the Great Society in a lot of ways. A lot of what happened in the New Deal was meant to be temporary, and a lot of it indeed was, although some of it, you know, lived forever. Tennessee Valley Authority and Social Security and things like that, although Social Security was never intended to be temporary. But the difference is the New Deal was enacted in response to, you know, a genuine worldwide economic emergency, and there was war on the horizon and all the rest of that stuff. And Roosevelt and his guys were, for the most part, trying out ideas that were new and untested. It was mostly wrong. Most of the stuff they did ended up being counterproductive. They weren't very good programs. There were things that you don't want to keep around for the rest of your life. But they were experimenting, and they were experimenting during a time of genuine crisis. So I don't think that what they were doing was really designed to get people hooked on welfare and hooked on government dependency. Roosevelt himself worried a lot about that, and if you look at the structure of a lot of these programs, I think that comes through. But the Great Society is exactly the opposite. You know, we declare war on poverty in the 1960s at a time in which poverty has been going down for decades, been going down steeply. We open up the first Job Corps office in a year in which the unemployment rate is less than 5%. So we were solving a problem with the war on poverty that had largely already begun to solve itself. And if you look at the way the programs are structured, you look at the fact that poverty was declining before we declared war on poverty and then began to climb again afterward. You look at the taxes, you look at the creations of the bureaucracies, and you look at the political behavior of people who not only receive these welfare checks, but the people who administer the welfare bureaucracies. And you start to think that maybe there's something else going on here other than just trying to help sick people and poor children.
All right. My guest is Kevin Williamson. So, Kevin, before we leave this Great Society debate and move on to something else, I do want to ask about the correlation between taxes and the dependency agenda that you have set up here. Because you talk about a time where poverty was on the decline before we instituted the Great Society. All right, I'll buy that. However, taxes were incredibly high at that period, and we've been slowly lowering taxes, certainly from the high astronomical heights that we had during the 1960s. So give me the correlation between taxes and this war on poverty.
Yeah, well, taxes actually weren't that high. Now, the top marginal tax rate was very high, you know, it was 90% or something.
Sure, and that's where most of my listeners live, Kevin, so, you know, you got to understand that's where we're coming
but,
from.
At the time when the rates were that high, basically nobody paid it. It was, you know, it was 1 to 1.5% of households were paying taxes at that top rate, whereas a lot of households pay at our tax rate now. You know, it's I forget the exact number. It's maybe 18 to 21% of households pay at the top rate. But the real correlation is that taxes function to make people more dependent in the long run. You know, the median American household, if you run their income numbers across their lives, their working career from their first job till the time they retire. If they had put the money they pay in payroll taxes, which fund Social Security and Medicare, into a normal retirement fund, you know, depending on what you assume the return is, say between, you know, 5 and 7% in real terms, they retire with something between $900,000 and $1.2 million just in what they paid in taxes to support Social Security and Medicare. That's significant. You know, most people, I think, right now would rather have $1 million than a government welfare check for the rest of their lives.
Well, certainly. But you're also assuming a 7% net gain on that. And that's been pretty hard to come by these days as well, Kevin. So
yeah, well, I've run it from, you know, assumptions of 4 to assumptions of 8. And so you get, you know, you get from the high 6 figures to the low 7 figures.
All right. My guest is Kevin Williamson. So, Kevin, connect the dots for my listeners. How did we get from Lyndon Baines Johnson to Barack Obama and this sort of systematic approach to keeping the Democratic Party in power that you posit in your book?
Well, they've discovered that Johnson's model works really very well politically. You know, anytime anyone tries to do something to reform Medicare, you know, they scream, oh, they're going to take away your Medicare. They do these commercials with Paul Ryan pushing a grandmother over the cliff in her wheelchair. And people really respond to that because people panic. You know, once you've started giving people something, it's really very difficult to take it away. Johnson knew this, and Johnson knew in the 60s that his party was losing its hold on some of the traditional voters, the white middle class, especially, but also some of the northern voters, and he saw the, you know, rise of the conservative movement, anti-communism, and all the rest of it. He knew that their built-in constituency of you know, angry white Southerners and black northern liberals and northern liberals in general was not going to hold together forever, and he needed something to try to win back the essentially the white working class that he thought he was going to lose, and partly the white middle class as well. And his idea was, we'll write him a check. And his background, of course, was in the New Deal. You know, it was the New Deal that brought him to Congress, really. And he learned his lessons well there.
Well, now, he came to power in 1948. That was well beyond the New Deal, wasn't it?
Oh, no, when he was in the House.
In the House. All right, fair enough. So let me ask you this. I want to ask you about a couple of Democratic presidents and how they fit into this panoply of Democratic systematically keeping people hooked on welfare. And I'm going to start with President Bill Clinton. He was a pro-business president. The economy boomed under Clinton. He raised taxes. So how does Clinton fit into this picture?
Yeah, well, you know, Clinton, of course, was very fortunate in the timing of his presidency. We did have a great economy during those years, which I don't think had much to do with government policy. I mean, some things it did. You know, Clinton and Gingrich, although they despised each other, were able to work together and put us on a track towards something like a more balanced budget. We never actually really balanced the budget. That's kind of a myth, but we got very close to it. And that was certainly good for the country. Higher taxes were part of that, and I'm certainly okay with that. You know, I think taxes should match spending. Now, I'd prefer there be less spending, but if you're going to spend money, you know, you've got to pay for it. So Clinton and Gingrich, in spite of themselves, managed between the two of them to keep the government on a more or less reasonably responsible path, and that was a good thing. Welfare reform, of course, was a part of that, although not as big a part as some conservatives would like to think that it was. But what really happened mostly in those years was that you had a great big boom in the tech bubble, which has its origins really in the early 1980s with some reform of telecom policy and such things. And that produced a lot of extra tax revenue, particularly in capital gains taxes with all the IPOs that were going on then. And that made life a lot easier for the federal government. He was rhetorically pro-business, I think, and he was certainly constrained by Gingrich and the Republicans from being as far left as he might have liked to have been on some things. I mean, I don't really think he wanted to do welfare reform. He just kind of had to. So that was, that's kind of how democracy is supposed to work, where you've got different parties exercising pressure on each other in a virtuous kind of way. Unfortunately, it's not working much like that anymore.
Well, no, it's not, and we don't have time to go into that, Kevin. But I do want to continue on with another president, mm-hmm. and it's sort of the converse of Bill Clinton. Where does Jimmy Carter fit amongst the Democratic presidents then?
Well, you know, Carter was a mess, obviously, for a lot of reasons. He didn't really understand how the economy worked. He imposed a lot of very narrow ideological preferences on public policy having to do with energy and conservation and such things. But if we're going to talk about welfare presidents, you know, we shouldn't restrict ourselves Democrats, because George W. Bush, of course, oversaw the biggest expansion of the welfare state since Lyndon Johnson in the form of Medicare Part D, the prescription drug benefit, which will add, you know, billions and billions of dollars to the national debt over the years, will permanently distort market arrangements in the prescription drug market. You know, it's not just a Democratic thing. Everybody wants to be Santa Claus, you know, because it's easier to get elected as Santa Claus than as the Grinch. You know, it's easier to get elected on a program of let me give you something than on a program of we've got to straighten ourselves out and I have to take something away from you.
All right. My guest is Kevin Williamson. We're talking about his book, The Dependency Agenda. So let me ask you a qualifying question then. How is Jimmy Carter different than Barack Obama?
Well, gosh, that's a long discussion. Carter, in some ways, was undone by circumstances partly beyond his control. You know, the worldwide economic problems that were happening during the Carter administration were not really the result of the policies of Jimmy Carter. Now, his policies were bad enough and would have caused trouble if they had been let to do their own, but it was just he was simply overtaken by events. Barack Obama is doing, you know, something very different. He is fulfilling a long-term liberal dream of massively expanding the welfare state by getting almost all the population, if not all the population, to somewhat dependent on government for its health care. And once you've done that, you know, it's really hard to turn that back. I can't think of any European country or any advanced economy once it's gone toward having, you know, really highly government-subsidized, highly government-provided health care that's ever gone back the other way. Now, before Obamacare was passed, of course, we were still already half socialized. You know, 50 cents out of every health care dollar spent in the United States was spent by the government before Obamacare was passed. Now it's going to be, you know, quite a bit bigger. And I think that that is a well-thought-out political program. I mean, I don't think Obamacare is going to make anyone's health care any better. I don't think it's actually going to improve the functioning of the healthcare marketplace in the United States, which God knows it had problems before this act was passed. It wasn't a very good system, but the reforms in which we're enacting under the rubric of the PPACA are not really probably going to make the world a better place, but they are going to allow Democrats for years from now to say, well, if you vote for those Republicans, you're going to take away your health care.
Yeah, that is true. My guest has been Kevin Williamson, author of the book, The Dependency Agenda. Kevin, you have probably piqued the interest of many of my listeners. If they want to learn more about you, learn more about the book, where would you direct them to go on the Internet?
Go to nationalreview.com, and you can check out my blog there, which is called Exchequer, or I also write for The Corner and for the magazine. Or you can find The Dependency Agenda at Encounter Books or at Amazon. And there are links all over the place, so I'm not too hard to find.
All right, Kevin, it has been great. Thank you so much for being my guest here on The Bill Frank Show. We'll talk to you down the road.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Thank you.